Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vaitalingam, and today's interview, recorded on the 15th of April 2010, is with Claudio Borio, who is Deputy Head of the Monetary and Economic Department and Director of Research and Statistics at the Bank for International Settlements.
Claudio, I wonder if we could start by talking about before the crisis, if you like. I think it's generally agreed that the great moderation, as it's called, of inflation and the business cycle led most of us to believe we'd found the secret of successful macroeconomic policymaking. So where, in your view, did the pre-crisis consensus go wrong?
The key problem was the view that price stability was itself sufficient for macroeconomic stability. The idea that if you stabilized inflation over a horizon of, say, 1 to 2 years ahead, you would automatically stabilize the real economy, and which was one of the reasons, not the only reason, but one of the reasons for adopting inflation targeting regimes. And this was supported analytically by the benchmark models that we're still using today, actually, the new Keynesian dynamic stochastic general equilibrium models, particularly the variant in which the only frictions, as you know, are price frictions, so that you get this divine coincidence, as Blanchard called it, whereby stabilizing prices actually stabilizes the whole economy. But what I think really went wrong more generally is the fact that people have a sufficiently long historical perspective, and they were just drawing lessons from the post-war inflationary period in order to understand a situation which was slowly but fundamentally changing as a result of changes in the monetary regime, what was happening to monetary policy, and what was happening to financial markets.
You talk a little bit about the fact that we thought the price stability was all we needed to do, but then we saw this build-up of financial imbalances. Can you explain that idea a little bit more?
If we actually go back in history and we look at the experience of, say, the pre-Second World War period, it was actually quite common, particularly in the gold standard period, to see a situation in which price stability for very long periods actually preceded financial or economic busts in general. So the nature of the business cycle at the time was quite different. And the Great Depression was the most spectacular example of that. The Roaring Twenties were characterized by stable, if not even gently falling inflation. And, of course, they ushered in the worst economic depression in history. And the key factor about these economic fluctuations at the time was the bigger role that financial factors played. Credit and asset price booms that then turned into busts were a typical feature of the economic environment. And what at the BIS we called financial imbalances, that is the slow buildup of financial imbalances on the back of credit and asset price expansion, which leads to overstretched balance sheets, aggressive risk-taking, that at some point has to be unwound. So it is not just a question of the boom preceding the bust, but of the boom actually causing the subsequent bust. And I'm sure that a number of economists were aware of this. They were aware that there was nothing new about what we were seeing, what we could have been seeing recently. But basically, looking back at the gold standard experience, they basically thought that it was completely irrelevant. Actually, I think that it was particularly relevant because that was the last time when we saw in history the conjunction of a liberalized financial market, on the one hand, with a monetary policy framework or regime that yielded credible price stability. And we hadn't seen that in the post-war period until recently. We had highly regulated financial markets until the early 80s. We had high inflation from the 70s onwards. And so people had thought that the main cause of business fluctuations was how you dealt with inflation. You let inflation run away, then you had to respond to it, and that was basically leading to the stop-go policies that we saw, particularly in the 70s. But in the early 80s, the central banks managed to bring down inflation in a stable way, and at the same time, financial markets became liberalized again. So what we saw was an emergence of business cycles that was very similar to what we had seen in the past, but we had completely forgotten. And I think that the first clear evidence of this was the Japanese crisis, but people tended to think of this as an aberration. Then you had the Asian boom that turned into a bust, and again, people thought that that was very specific to Asia. But then, of course, what we saw in the recent example is precisely that, a global financial cycle that has ended in tears. I do think that there is an element of great tragedy to all this. If you do take a very long historical perspective, I think that one can safely say that what goes around comes around.
Well, perhaps we can talk about how we deal with the tears and how we tackle the tragedy in terms of the policy response, particularly of central banks. I mean, central banks around the world have used what have collectively become known as unconventional monetary policies. I'd be interested in getting your view of how we should think about these policies of quantitative easing and credit easing and mm-hmm. enhanced credit support and whether they are effective.
The pre-crisis consensus was that the policy rate, the very short-term policy rate, say typically an overnight rate that the central bank was setting, was sufficient to fully characterize monetary policy. So central banks controlled the short-term rate, and through expectations of future changes in policy rates, they were controlling the whole term structure. And that's all you needed to know in order to understand the impact of monetary policy on the economy. Now, analytically, the underpinning of this is, of course, the assumption that there is perfect substitutability across assets, so that quantities do not matter. You just put in more of one asset, you take out another asset, but at the end of the day, prices do not really change, the prices of the underlying assets. Now, what's the core element of what people now call unconventional monetary policies is the fact that the central bank actively uses its balance sheet not to influence the short-term rate, but to influence long-term rates and asset prices and financial conditions more generally. So they try to affect credit terms, they try to affect credit spreads. And they do so, I would say, and I would add, irrespective or in a completely decoupled way from what is happening to the short-term rate. So you have a clear distinction between interest rate policy, which is influencing the short-term rate on the one hand, and what P.T. Dizziatat and I called in a paper balance sheet policy on the other, which is trying to influence these asset prices and these financial conditions by changing the composition of the central bank balance sheet in an active way. Let me say a couple of things about this. First of all, that these policies are not that unconventional in general. That we have had an example of a typical balance sheet policy for a long time, but we haven't called it unconventional, and that's foreign exchange intervention, whereby the central bank basically goes in and changes the supply of foreign exchange assets in the private sector portfolios. Because the key to balance sheet policies is that the central bank affects its own balance sheet, and by doing that, it changes the composition of the balance sheet of the private sector. And these policies assume that or are only effective to the extent that the assets that the central bank is putting into the private sector balance sheets are not perfect substitutes among each other. So effectively, we're again here undermining one of the key assumptions that we're using in our macroeconomic models, which is perfect substitutability across assets. Are these policies effective? Well, I would say that there is no doubt that by buying up assets, by extending credit at more favorable terms that the markets would do, the central banks have definitely been able to reduce the contraction in aggregate demand in the economy.
On the whole, Claudio, you think that the unconventional monetary policies have been effective, but you also think there are some costs. Can you explain that in a little more detail?
Yes, I think that basically two types of cost. The first type of cost is in terms of market functioning. In the process of carrying out these policies, the central bank is really substituting itself for private sector intermediation. And this can have significant impact in terms of resource allocation, and it can make the private sector unduly dependent on public support, delaying, for example, the necessary adjustment in balance sheets that may have to occur for there to be a sustainable economic recovery. Probably the more important set of costs are of a political economy nature, and that is that these policies in the medium term, they run the risk of undermining central banks' operational independence and its anti-inflation credentials. There are a number of reasons. One is that, of course, in carrying out these policies, central banks become exposed to significant financial costs, because as they extend credit beyond the normal maturities, they take on credit risk. As they purchase long-term government bonds, they take on market and interest rate risk. As they purchase foreign exchange, they take on foreign exchange market and sometimes credit risk. And although assets are not perfect substitutes, which allows these policies to have an effect, they're pretty close substitutes, which means that you really have to operate in very large quantities in order to have an effect, for example, when they're purchasing securities. And that explains why the balance sheet tends to balloon, which is one of the problems which we have seen these days. The other reason, of course, is the central banks get involved in level playing field considerations. The credit allocation questions, many people believe it's not really part of the central bank's business. And we should remember that political economy implications are really exacerbated by a simple fact. Central banks have a monopoly over interest rate policy, but they do not have a monopoly over balance sheet policy, because almost any balance sheet policy that the central bank does can be replicated by the government. And conversely, any balance sheet policy that the central bank implements has an impact on the consolidated government sector balance sheet. And it is only in the context of that consolidated balance sheet that one can really assess their effectiveness. For example, the central bank may be trying to buy long-term paper in order to reduce the yield, and the debt management office may actually try to extend the maturity to try and lock in a low borrowing cost. So they could be operating in ways that are inconsistent with each other. So there are lots of issues that have to do with coordination, operational independence, and the division of responsibilities. And at the end of the day, there is a risk that this could undermine the anti-inflation credentials of the central bank.
Why don't we move on and talk a little bit more about sort of the future practice of monetary policy, if you like, both in terms of theory and in terms of its implementation by central banks. But maybe if we start off with the practice, where you see things going in terms of the continued use of interest rate policy and balance sheet policy in combination, and when we will see the unwinding of some of these unconventional policies.
When we will see the unwinding of these policies, this is something that I definitely leave to each central bank to decide. I think that the main point that I would like to make, and that it's sometimes not fully appreciated, is that you can fully decouple the exit from interest rate policy from the exit from balance sheet policy, so that you can basically carry out the two independently and responding to different considerations. And technically, all that you need to do in order to make sure that you can do this is to what you might call insulate the impact of your balance sheet policies, of your credit extension, of your purchase of the assets, from the market of central bank reserves. And in particular, from making sure that any increase in central bank reserves that does take place doesn't have an impact on the short-term rate. So you can insulate this market two ways. The old and traditional way that I think is most common across central bank is basically by sterilizing the operations. So you drain the bank reserves that are the counterpart to the purchase of the assets. Another way of doing that, and this is basically what, for example, the Bank of England is doing, is to pay interest on reserves at the policy rate. And if you do that, effectively, the bank reserves and other short-term assets issued by the government become perfect substitutes. So there is no impact on the policy rate and the market rate. So you can decouple the two.
Claudia, what about the future practice of monetary policy in terms of dealing with the emergence of what many people call bubbles? You've used the expression that the pre-crisis consensus was it was better to clean than to lean, by which I understand you to mean that you clean up when the bubble bursts rather than try and lean against the wind while it emerges. Mm-hmm. What do you think the prospects of that kind of debate are going to be going forward?
I don't know how far the debate will go. I do sense that there has been a certain shift in the direction of the lean camp as opposed to just the clean camp. And I think that basically three reasons for this. And by the way, by leaning, to be precise, I mean that what you do need is to have policy frameworks, monetary policy frameworks, that would allow the central bank to tighten policy, to lean against the buildup of these financial imbalances, these credit and asset price booms that I mentioned earlier. Even if near-term inflationary pressures remain subdued. There are basically three reasons, I think, why the consensus is shifting. The first one is that I think it's become more and more obvious that the crisis was indeed the result of a major financial cycle of the type that I described earlier. We did see the build-up of leverage in the banking system. We did see the build-up of leverage in the economy as a whole. We saw a major expansion of credit and asset prices. And, of course, we saw aggressive risk-taking on the part of the private sector. And we have done also some more technical empirical work that confirms this. In fact, it shows that you can build up real-time indicators, that is, indicators that are based only in information which is available at the time the policymakers are making decisions, of financial imbalances, which are based on simple deviations of credit and asset prices from historical norms. And these simple indicators have predictive content for financial crises, from economic recessions, and for unwelcome disinflation, well, over horizons that are, say, 2 to 4 years ahead, which are especially important for policy. The second reason is that, of course, cleaning has proved much more costly than people had expected in the past. There are the economic and social costs of the crisis. We have seen that monetary policy is effective, but at the same time, there are a number of complications of policy at the zero lower bound. We have seen the financial costs of the bailouts, and we have seen something that is going to have longer-term implications, the major fiscal policy expansion, which could actually raise serious economic problems ahead. And the third reason is that I think that there is a growing, although by no means universal, sense that monetary policy did help to accommodate the build-up of these financial imbalances. Now, analytically, the reason is rather simple. If monetary policy responds only to near-term inflationary pressures and these remain subdued, stable, or indeed if inflation is falling, then monetary policy will offer no resistance to the build-up of financial imbalances. It will offer no resistance to the credit expansion and the increase in asset prices. And we should not forget that monetary policy sets the universal price of leverage, that is, the universal price of borrowing costs, and that can be a very powerful tool. In terms of the evidence, we know that the period that preceded the crisis saw unusually and persistently low, even negative, real interest rate. In fact, the lowest since the 1970s. And we've seen growing empirical evidence that lower interest rates, especially relative to historical norms again, tend to heighten risk-taking. That is, they can influence risk perceptions, risk tolerance, what economists call the price of risk. And this is what we have termed in some of our work the risk-taking channel of monetary policy. So all of these reasons have been changing the consensus towards, well, maybe we should not just clean, but we should also lean.
Can we talk a little bit about the research agenda for macroeconomics? I mean, lots of people have said that this is a crisis for the discipline. And we've talked a little bit about the pre-crisis consensus. Can you give us your view of where we go from here, what we can build on from what we had in the past and where we need to really open up and develop new understandings of how these things work?
I think that the priority going forward is to basically develop a new approach to business fluctuations, to business cycles. And I think we should be moving away from the prevalent view nowadays, which is basically to regard business cycles as the result of exogenous shocks that hit the economy and then the economy quickly returns to equilibrium, to a steady state equilibrium, and rather move towards a framework or a paradigm that allows for the endogenous generation of booms and bust cycles, where, as I mentioned earlier, the boom does not just precede the bust, but actually causes the bust for some of the reasons that I mentioned before. Now, this is required to have financial factors at the core of the models so that they would also allow for the endogenous development of the occasional financial imbalance. And they would have to assign an important role to time-varying risk tolerance, to risk premia, to money and credit, to balance sheets and to stocks, things that we have completely left out in recent years, to non-linearities and to discontinuities in economic fluctuations. And I think we'll have to move away from the prevalent simple view that expectations are rational so that people do not make systematic mistakes in what they expect the future is going to be, because endemic uncertainty is what we all have to struggle with. And the very fact that you had so many different views about what was going on in the economy and what was being, whether the economy's expansion was sustainable or whether we were going to have a big bust, is a clear indication that we do not have rational or model-consistent expectations, as we all assume in our models. This, of course, is a broad research agenda because it requires blending together academic traditions which have really followed separate paths in the past. It requires work at the intersection between finance, risk measurement and management, and risk pricing, and monetary economics. It requires us to rediscover the role of money and credit in aggregate economic fluctuations and in macroeconomics generally, in the very notion of liquidity in its all its various forms. It's absolutely fundamental. It will require us to incorporate into macro models, those cross-sectional and intertemporal coordination failures that have been completely left out by our assumption of a single, all-omniscient representative agent in the economy. And I think we'll need to rediscover an older and very distinguished, actually, academic tradition that goes back to the pre-Second World War in macroeconomics. That sees business cycles as disequilibrium fluctuations in which monetary and financial factors, as I said earlier, really play an essential and not a peripheral role.
Claudio Borrero, thank you very much.